This is the House Einstein podcast number 4 with Osman Parvez and Hamish Crabb.
Howdy, howdy.
Welcome to the podcast. It's been a number of years since I've put together a podcast. We experimented with it back in 2018. And at the time, we recorded podcasts that were surrounding community members, that were attempts to connect with others in the community. And in bringing the podcast back, the mission is a little different. We are going to talk about real estate topics specifically, and they don't necessarily apply just to Boulder. They apply to real estate in general. And just keep in mind that in the United States, real estate is regulated at the state level. So the rules that apply here in Colorado and how business is done here in Colorado may not apply to you in Florida or in Massachusetts or in California. And you should consult with a local real estate advisor and not take this podcast to be your sole source of information. And the attorneys that I've worked with probably would like me to say that these podcasts should be experienced as entertainment and are certainly not real estate or financial advice. And that is just a little CYA language to make sure that we're all on the same page for what this content represents. All right, with that said, the topic of this podcast, podcast number 4, is a revisit to a piece of content I wrote a long time ago, and it's really about questions that you, as a consumer, should ask people that you are interviewing to be your realtor. So if you're thinking about buying or selling a house, these are the types of questions you might want to consider asking. And after 20 years in the business of real estate, I think that these questions that I would come up with might be quite different from the questions that you would come up with as somebody who just buys and sells homes, unless you happen to sell a lot of homes in your lifetime. And I wrote this original article, so we're going to provide a link. Hamish, can you make sure that's in the show notes, to the article I wrote way back in 2007. And I'm going to go through this article first and hit these questions and then hit some updated questions as well. And hopefully this stirs your thinking and helps you find a better realtor. And maybe that means avoiding some bad realtors, bad real estate agents. Not everyone is a realtor, by the way. I should add that. And the end of the day is going to help you make a smarter real estate decision, which is our mission here at House Einstein, our real estate brokerage here in Boulder, Colorado. Hamish, do you have anything to add?
I think that's about it. We should definitely make sure to return back to the realtor versus real estate agent discussion. I think that's an important distinction.
Yep.
Kind of in the when you're getting into the world of real estate. So.
Well, maybe we should just hit on it right now before we jump into it, and that is, realtors are subject to the National Association of Realtors Code of Ethics, and the term realtor is actually a trademark of the National Association, and it may sound like just a bunch of words, but it actually has teeth. And if you're working with a licensed real estate agent who is also a realtor, then and you have an issue with how they've behaved, whether or not they're even your real estate agent, let's say you're on the other side of the deal and the realtor that is representing your counterparty has behaved in an unethical way, you can file a complaint with the National Association, and they actually take it incredibly serious, and they can fine that agent a large amount of money. They can kick them out of the association. They can make their life quite difficult. So this is a level of oversight that extends past the state licensing. Here in Colorado, we're licensed by the Division of Real Estate, the Commission. And the Commission also has a lot of things they will hold us accountable to and also has a complaint process. But the National Association, especially when it comes to ethics, can really make life miserable for realtors that decide that they can behave outside of those that code of ethics. So thanks for asking the question, Hamish, and bringing us back to it. All right, let me jump into this. So go to the article, and it was written and published. It was published July 9th, 2007. So I've been doing this a long time. But these questions, you know, the intention was originally, let me go through these old questions and revise them. And I thought, why not do it as part of the podcast? So this is now 13, 15 years old, 16, almost 16 years ago I wrote this piece. And I'm just going to jump into the questions themselves. So we're going to kind of skip through the intro section really quick. And it mentions, by the way, the company name has changed. It references Realty Unique, which is our LLC. As the company grew, we abandoned Realty Unique as a brand. It's still the LLC, and our company is now House Einstein. It is trademarked. That is that it's the same entity. So when I say Realty Unique in this article, I'm really referring to the same brokerage.
DBA.
Right, DBA. Although back in 2007, I guess I should clarify even more. House Einstein was founded in 2013. And when I wrote this article, I was part of a different brokerage, but we retained the content. So it now refers to the brokerage we're with. Okay. Whew.
So storied here are 12 history.
Storied in a lot of detail that maybe doesn't mean anything to other people, but means something to me. There is a backstory to how everyone got into this profession. And as it happens, that's our very first question. So the very first question you may want to ask somebody you're interviewing to be your agent is, how did you get into the real estate profession? And my answer at the time was, this is an easy one to get the conversation rolling. What you're looking for is enthusiasm for the business, commitment, and experience. As a general interview tip, it's a good idea to keep conversation light before you start delving into other questions. You may wish to ask about their involvement in the community as well, participating in civic and local nonprofits. Civic affairs, I would add, if I was editing this, are a good sign that the agent has strong ethics and community-oriented values. You know, my answer to this question, I guess I should answer how I would do so if I was being asked this question, is it was sort of an accident. Hamish, I don't even know how much you know about the backstory, but I certainly didn't grow up thinking real estate was going to be my life profession. And in fact, I thought I would be in medicine, and I studied biology. Both of my parents are physicians. I have a lot of family members that are also physicians and lawyers. It's sort of the two family businesses that seem to be across generations and family groups that I'm related to. And at the end of my undergraduate schooling, I knew I didn't want to go into medicine, didn't know what I wanted to do. I worked in sales for a year and decided to pursue a master's in business administration and MBA. I specialized in finance. You have a choice in your specialization when you get an MBA. And I chose finance because it was the closest thing to science. And I loved the science. I loved the rigor of science, but I knew I didn't want to be in a lab somewhere. And at the time, I couldn't really see a career path moving forward other than medicine from my biology degree. And I certainly didn't want to specialize in something very narrow in the sciences. So an MBA is a nice generalist degree and opens doors, especially when you're not sure what you want to do with your career path. And finance was the closest thing to science, and I really enjoyed it. I got amazing grades, actually, for my graduate level degree. I didn't do amazing in undergrad. I did okay, but I passed. I got the degree, but I did much, much better in grad school after having worked for a year in the real world. And after grad school, I was involved with a startup here in Boulder. That startup did not succeed. After a year, we shut it down. I moved back to New York. I worked in the investment community. But after a couple of years in the investment community, analyzing publicly traded companies and feeling kind of lost because I was missing all the green space here in Boulder. It takes hours to get to someplace even close to, and it's not close, but someplace you can go hiking and what felt like being in nature to me. I decided I needed to stop. And so through a roundabout way, I stumbled into real estate. I worked for an environmental consulting company in Boston, and then I moved to Nantucket where I worked at a youth hostel making $8 an hour and living on the beach. So I went from Wall Street to youth hostel in the course of about 4 years. And at the end of that summer, there were reasons I needed to stay on the island that were regarding the woman I was dating, and I didn't want to leave. And I knew eventually I wanted to come back to Boulder. But because of that relationship, I stayed. And I've always been extremely entrepreneurial, willing to try anything. I swung hammers and found, I bought a Popular Mechanics red-handled hammer, Popular Mechanics branded red-handle safety hammer, and a leather tool belt. And I started cold calling construction companies. And I got a job working as an entry-level carpenter, having cold called construction companies, which is a glorified way of saying you got to do job cleanup and demo, because they don't trust you to do anything else when you're just starting out. But that was $20 an hour and allowed me to stay on the island. And after a few months of that, I was interviewing and looking for work, and I stumbled into an opportunity with a real estate brokerage that had just put under contract a Vanderbilt mansion to develop a private club called the Westmore Club. Actually, I don't even know if it had been named yet when they hired me. And they hired me to build a financial model and help them raise money for that project, coincidentally from Lehman Brothers, which is a whole nother story. And the owner of that brokerage, the owners asked me to help the brokers, the real estate brokers, while I was also helping with this development project. And during the course of that, I realized that in making marketing plans and doing opinions of value for residential property on Nantucket, that this was an underserved area. And I have the analytical skills, but not the sales skills that the brokers had. And these brokers seem to be really enjoying their life a lot more than me. I need to like really beef up on my social skills and my deal skills. And so I got a real estate license. I did one deal during the time I was on Nantucket. And I helped that commercial project reach success. So when it got through its last stage of its hurdles, its investment hurdles, I was able to leave. And my then partner and I moved to Boulder. I offered to open the brokerage here in Boulder, but the founder said no, he didn't want to do that. So we moved to Boulder without a plan. I hung my license with RE/MAX, and for the first 6 months, we were at it desperately trying to find leads and develop a business. And by the end of that summer, we were basically out of cash, and we'd run up credit cards. I mean, the real estate business is tough, especially if you have just the most basic level of friendships and connections. Like if you've been in the community for 30 years, it's very easy to start a business in real estate. And a lot of people do that as a second career. But for me, we didn't know anybody. I mean, we knew a couple of people, my old roommates when I lived in Boulder years earlier, for example. Boy, this is going to get long, Hamish, if I don't get to the point, right? Like I wasn't planning to do this full backstory, but here we are. So let's keep going with it. The intention is to have this podcast be about an hour. but if you think it's going too long-winded, you have full permission to cut me to the point. I'll just wrap up the story real quick, and then we'll move on. But the bottom line is I got a lot of intellectual rigor from the investment world. And at the end of that summer, I went back to the investment world, back to cold calling, researched an investment firm in Denver that was doing very interesting things, called somebody in that company, and pitched him on me as an analyst, and they created an interview opportunity for me from that experience, and they ended up hiring me, and I left that. I was at that company for a couple of years while I was building the blog and doing real estate lead development when I was trying to grow our real estate business, my ex and I, and so back in the investment community. I left that firm as the Associate Director of Capital Markets. God, I don't remember. I think that was my title. It's been a few years, more than a few years. And when the global financial crisis hit in 2007, 2008, and there was a housing meltdown, I decided it was time to leave the investment firm and go full-time into real estate because our business was finally on much more sustainable footing. And the investment firm actually was having some trouble at that time. So I volunteered for an exit, for a layoff, and they gave it to me. And that allowed me to go full-time into real estate. But between that time, I was still blogging, still generating leads, still having conversations with buyers and sellers, But my ex was doing the primary business of the showings and handling the physical on the ground aspects of the deal. I was mostly doing content development, content and lead development. So that's how I got into real estate. And today I bring those analytical skills. I can't turn it off. I can't stop talking about real estate like it's an investment class, because it's just how my mind is programmed, how I think about it. I still think it's massively underserved by the investment community. We're talking about billions of dollars just here in our local market alone, and there's no analyst coverage. And the people that buy these houses, particularly as the market has gotten more affluent, expect a high standard of service like they would get from a tax professional, like they would get from an investment advisor, and instead they often deal with mom and pop people or a friend who is a part-time realtor or got their license only a few years ago from a different industry and aren't really service focused. So I saw that as that's our business opportunity. This is what we can do that other people can't do, is bring in analytics, be obsessive about due diligence, focus on negotiation skills, and act like an investment advisor, not like a salesperson. And that was the foundations of House Einstein and the brokerage that preceded it, which when my ex and I split, she got that brokerage. So that's how I got in the business, if you're asking me that question. And I obviously have not practiced that question in a while, because it should really take about 60 seconds to say all those things instead of 10 minutes.
Well, it's interesting, because at the end you started to touch on what I think is a pretty important takeaway on this first question, is what's your motivation? And I noticed that you brought up kind of your analyst perspective and your data-driven approach to it. And typically, in the circles that I'm with and the people that I know, real estate's more or less seen as a get-rich-quick type of strategy, or make-money-quick. And that's where you find yourself a lot of these salesy types of people who are going to try and get your foot in the door and get you closed, rather than, you know, it's our slogan, but help you make a smarter real estate decision. And so in that first question, you know, you really want to, it kind of gives you the context of the agent and where their motivation is and how they got into real estate to begin with, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the point of the question, is to get a sense of why are they drawn to this industry. And
yeah,
it never occurred to me as a distinguishing factor, but I grew up with my dad doing house calls as a physician, like literally going with him in the car. And it was a different time in the 80s and 90s, and in a much smaller town where people really knew each other and took care of each other, and reputation mattered, and integrity mattered. And that was just the background of what I felt like was my youth. So that was actually one of my challenges on Wall Street, was I felt like the ethics were so broken, at least in the firm I worked for, that I couldn't stomach what we were doing. It was really a conflict. The money was great. When I left Wall Street, it took me almost a decade to make the same amount of money I was making. But I could live with myself. I could look at my face in the mirror and not feel like I'm selling out everything of value just to maximize dollars. And so, yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the question. And there are lots of other great agents out there. It's not that I'm the only one. But I do want to say that 80% of agents fail within the first 3 years, statistically. And that's the latest number. I used to say 70, but somebody told me it's actually closer to 80. So I'm now saying 80. Maybe it's somewhere between 70 and 80. I do like to be accurate with statistics, but so I think we'll say 70 to 80% of agents fail within the first 3 years. It is a tough business, and a lot of people are drawn to it because of the ability to make a commission check quickly if you have the network. And you may want to watch out for agents that are relatively new to the business and have a massive network, because you don't, just because they've been around for a long time and you like them as a friend, doesn't mean that you've worked with them as your representative. And you may find that conflict of interest comes back to bite you.
There's the saying, right? Don't do business with friends. And so,
I mean, you can. You just should know who this person really is in a business setting. And trust is important. If you don't trust their advice, you're going to find it a challenging transaction. So hopefully they know what they're doing when they give you that advice. That's the key, is to make sure they actually are offering advice based on experience in the industry and in life, not advice that's designed to get the closing done because they want to get paid.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a filter there, you know, that you've got to kind of see through. These are... like read between the line questions as much as they are direct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. So, exactly. Okay, let me move on to the next question. What's your preferred negotiation strategy, or how might you go about negotiating an offer to buy or sell for me? And the answer I wrote in 2007, I have not edited this. I wrote, ultimately, the agent should follow your instructions for how to handle your transactions, so look for fresh ideas and a well-thought-out response. Most people will buy or sell real estate only a handful of times. Your agent will likely be handling a lifetime of negotiations every month. Their negotiation experience and skills become valuable and seasoned advice that could save you time, money, and frustration. Okay, I want to add that actually most agents are not handling a lifetime of negotiations every month. Most agents are doing 3 or 4 deals a year, and that's definitely not necessarily a lifetime every month. And after doing this for 20 years, I also want to say that sometimes you should push harder as an agent on your client. And yes, ultimately the client should be making the call for how to handle the negotiation, but seasoned real estate agents are experts in their field, and that includes negotiation skills, and there are norms. So pushing back on a norm can result in the deal going sideways pretty fast. So for example, there is an inspection, objection, and resolution process that is contractual in the state of Colorado. And the norm is for the buyer's agent to submit the list of objection items, the laundry list of here's what we don't like wrong with your house. And typically, the listing agent submits the resolution, the written resolution in the contract. And in between those two things, there's usually a verbal negotiation. But there's nothing that actually says the buyer's agent can't submit both the inspection objection and the inspection resolution at the same time. And sometimes that works really well, especially if you don't put it on the resolution form. If you submit it on the resolution form, for some reason it can be triggering for the other side. And I had a deal a few years ago that I submitted both on the formal contract document, and the agent, the listing agent on the other side, who I will not name, we have a principle, as I mentioned to Hamish before, we don't name, we criticize by category, and we praise by name. So I'm not going to criticize by name here, I'm going to criticize by category, but this agent's been doing business a long time and likes how she does business. She's pretty successful, particularly in one specific neighborhood. And if my clients want that neighborhood, we have to negotiate on her terms, but or at least in her style. Because if we try to do something like, you know, it's sort of like a chess match and somebody just suddenly moved two pieces at once and you didn't know you could do that. Like, I mean, obviously you can't do that in chess, but in real estate, in this particular thing, you can move two pieces. And because we really want that language to be accurate, right? We want that language to represent what our buyers want. But the process for crafting that language is usually collaborative between the buyer's agent and the listing agent. So so I wanted to add that. And we our clients still make the call, and we advise. But we do our best to try to help our clients be successful, and sometimes they get in their own way. But they're the ones that make the decisions. We are simply advisors in the process. And we also are verbal negotiators, and we, you know, if they want us to play hardball, we play hardball. More often than not, they don't want me to play hardball, and I'm more aggressive than they want to be. And again, it's our client's decision. I love negotiation. I think it might be an ethnic thing that I grew up in, and I was sharing this with you, Hamish, the other day, that when I was a kid in the grocery store walking through the checkout line, I literally watched my mom try to negotiate with, you know, a 16-year-old working the checkout counter at the grocery store over the price of some item that she just felt was egregiously high, and she just stopped the whole checkout line to barter. And I was like, what's happening? And it's, I call it bizarre culture, you know, bizarre being the, you know, the shopping bizarre, not the word strange. And I'm proud of it. I think I love negotiation. It's thrilling to help my clients get a better deal. But ultimately, if you're interviewing me, and my answer for you is, well, I'm going to look to you for how hard you want me to push. Because you're the one that gets the reward and the potential punishment of losing a deal if we negotiated too aggressively.
Yeah, I think you really hit most of the points on this one. I don't have too much to add, really.
Okay. All right, so let's hit the next one. Three, agents have an incentive to close deals quickly. How do you give buyers and sellers honest advice? And the answer I wrote in 2007 was, this hits a classic conflict of interest. Typically, an agent won't get paid unless the client actually buys something. Yet, in order to best serve the interests of a client, agents may need to advise clients not to buy or sell a particular home, or in some cases, to not buy or sell at all. At Realty Unique, now House Einstein, we see ourselves as advisors. Our goal is to give honest, objective advice, even when the results do not result in a commission. We may lose some clients in the short term, but we believe we'll grow our business in the long term by serving the best interests of our clients. Nothing's really changed here from 2007. The update is that I would say it's not sometimes we're telling our clients not to buy or sell. It's often we're telling our clients not to buy or sell. So if you're a seller, and most of my clients, all of my clients will probably attest to this, that say to me, Osmond, we're thinking about selling our house. Can you come by and take a look and tell us what you think it's worth? The answer is, of course, I'm happy to meet with you. And then when I get there, I'm also looking for ways to keep them from making a bad financial decision. Because real estate assets float with inflation. They are very difficult to outsupply. The supply is incredibly strained. And so I once asked a real estate, a very, very successful real estate advisor and mentor to me, if he ever regretted selling any of his properties. And he has sold a lot of them over the years. He currently owns a lot of them here in Boulder. And his answer to me was, yes, every single one. So the answer is, unless there's some incredible motivation, you should look at ways to keep it. Like maybe you want to just take out a line of credit against the house, a home equity loan to pay for whatever immediate needs you have. Maybe it's college tuition. But do you really want to sell it? I mean, real estate has so many ways to pull capital out. It's also tax advantaged. There are downsides. It's an active investment. You cannot just let it sit. It's not like buying stock. It is not passive, for sure. But at the same time, there are very few assets for which the tax code is so well set up as for the average person to be a real estate investor. So if there's a way to keep it, I encourage my clients to do so. And that's one of the first things I talk to about with sellers. And with buyers, when we go look at houses, and Hamish, you've been part of this conversation many times, like we go in looking for what's right and what's wrong. And I don't want to put a house under contract with my client only to have it break up on inspection for something that was visible and obvious. And it may not be visible and obvious to my buyer, but this is all I do is look at houses. Well, it's not all I do, but I do this a lot. I do this so much that it's like, okay, how do we help our client from wasting a bunch of time? And to point, I want to add one more piece. Our buyer agency actually has a very unique carve out because this is not a normal duty of a realtor or real estate agent to their client. I need to be clear about that. Real estate agents do not walk into houses normally and tell you what's right and what's wrong because they could later have liability for having done so. And our buyer agency agreement says Osmond will say what's right and what's wrong. Osmond will help you with due diligence. Osmond will even dump comps into a spreadsheet and put together a financial model for your investment decisions. However, you as a buyer recognize this is not a normal duty, and you as a buyer recognize you bear ultimate responsibility for these actions, and you hold Osmond to be harmless in the event the investment or purchase decision doesn't work out. And that CYA five sentences that my attorney was really not happy to write, but I made her write, is how we do business. So we walk into listings and we are very comfortable telling you to not write an offer on this house for any reason whatsoever. Or even if it was 20% less expensive, I still wouldn't buy a house that is in a bad location that has significant compromises that can't be fixed. So that's how I answer that question is, so I didn't really answer the question. How do you give honest advice? So I'm in the top 10% of agents here in Boulder, and I'm not really commission-driven anymore. I'm values-driven. And so we work with buyers and sellers at all price points, including affordable housing, all the way to the very end of the market, at the luxury end of the market. In fact, right now we have a client at both extremes that we're currently working with. And they're both getting very high levels of service, I would say equivalent levels of service. We are trying our best to help them make smart decisions. And it's after 20 years in this business, I'm not worried about one deal. and I will never push my clients into buying something. In fact, I'm much more likely to push them not to buy it. And especially if it's a bidding war, we have a whole different conversation of how much do you think it's worth? It's tough. They're tough questions to answer. But that's how I resolve that conflict of interest. And in the early days, I even gave people an option. I'm like, well, you know, we could just agree the commission is based on this dollar point. And if it's above it, I lose out. If it's below it, you lose out. Or we just come up with an average and we don't worry about the actual final sale price, because that way this conflict is removed. No one's ever taken me out up on that offer. No one's ever said, sure, let's do that structure. Because honestly, you should work with someone you trust. And if you need to legalize some sort of structure to keep the trust in place, it's probably not a good fit. And I've never had anybody take me up on that.
Yeah, I'll say our showings are pretty different, because it's not so much like, imagine living in this house or anything like that. It's like, are you going to be okay, you know, with only a 4-foot entryway? You know, are you going to be okay with the slight slant in the kitchen? You know, we're not necessarily pointing out deal breakers on these showings or client tours that we do, but we're more trying to set realistic expectations for our buyers. When they go in and they see these things, they might be distracted by the staging or something, but we're at this point so desensitized that it's easier for us to see through it and see the realities of the house, you know?
Yep. Also see past the clutter.
Yeah.
But sometimes people miss things. Like, do you notice how the house is lower than all of the neighbors in the backyard? That creates a psychological negative impact for most people. Most people want to feel elevated or at least at the same level as their neighbors. But if everyone's looking down on you, well, it feels like they're looking down on you. It doesn't feel good. It feels like you're in a fishbowl. It feels very uncomfortable psychologically. And so maybe other agents mention these things, but I don't know, because I don't go on showings with other agents other than the people on our team. But it's if we can point out something that's clear to us, as a positive or negative, we do so. Okay, ready for the next question?
Yep, let's hear it.
Question 4. How do you distinguish yourself from your competition? What makes you a better choice than other agents? And in 2007, I wrote, this question gives the agent a chance to highlight what they have to offer, and it reflects their professionalism. Ideally, the agent's response should focus on their strengths, but pay close attention when they talk about other agents. What they say about other agents may reflect more on themselves. It's a litmus test for their professionalism. I don't think I have anything to add to this one. I think I've already talked about how we're different, so we've covered that. Am I a better choice than other agents? The answer is it depends. Some people just feel more comfortable working with somebody that is maybe more in their age demographic, or somebody that they've known for years as their friend or friend of the family. You should work with the agent you feel really comfortable working with. And at the same time, you should know there's some downsides of working with people that are in your social circles. We've talked about that. It doesn't mean you shouldn't hire them, but you should at least consider some of those downsides. Like, it's hard to fire your friend when you find out they're not able to perform. And I do think that how people talk about others in their industry or in general is really a reflection of their beliefs about themselves. That might be a little bit more spiritual or more psychological, but I do think that there's some truth to that. So pay a particular attention to how they talk about people that aren't performing in the industry. There's a lot of shenanigans, I'll be completely honest. There are shenanigans in this industry, but there are also amazing agents who go so far beyond the call of what you would expect an agent to do. And I'm proud of the agents on this team. I think they do those things. They go the extra mile. And there are other agents in the profession that also go the extra mile. And the key is to get a sense of what you're really getting for the commission you're paying before you make your decision on who to hire.
And this ties into kind of our conversation on negotiation when we're talking about like inspection resolutions, and you have a little bit of verbal negotiation with the other agent. You know, if this agent that you're looking for speaks poorly about their colleagues, how do you think their verbal negotiations are going to go with other people in the industry or in that market? You know, you need an agent that can play fair and work well with others, because that's how it works here.
Right. You know, it is a small community. Yeah. And I like to benchmark us against the other top agents in town, and then I count how many deals all of these other agents that aren't in the top 20% or the top 10% do. And the top 10% are doing more business than the bottom 80. It's crazy how much business the top 10% does in terms of volume. And when you do deals with these same people over and over and over again, you get a sense for how they do business. And so I'll now praise by name. Every deal I've ever done with Patrick Dolan has gone smoothly. And even when things after closing did not go smoothly because his client did not perform, so there was an inspection resolution that was supposed to be paid after closing. That's one of those ahas, don't ever do that again. You really want to escrow funds if it's significant. But this wasn't a significant expense. It was a couple $100. It was an appliance repair. And the seller just ghosted. They didn't fix it. And I called Patrick and I said, your client is not paying for this repair after multiple attempts to contact them. Patrick called me back and said, the client's not going to do it. And I'm like, Patrick, we need to solve this. And so both of us wrote a check. We each covered half of it. And that felt fair to me because Patrick didn't have to cover anything. He doesn't have a relationship at all with my client. It's not his fault his client is behaving poorly. So he behaved in a very ethical way. I was very grateful. It was a small number in the end of the day for the size of the deal, but this is well after the deal closed. And he listened to the concern. He valued our relationship. He did the right thing. And every deal with Patrick has been like that. Well, they haven't all had problems, but they've all had good communication, solid ethics. He's a top agent, and there's a reason. So there you go. Praise by name. Patrick, if you're listening, that's a shout out for you. All right. Should we move on to the next one?
Yeah.
Okay, question 5. What's the toughest part of your job? And my answer in 2007 was, this question may give you insight into what a working relationship might look like down the road. The question's also a bit of a trap. If they say nothing or they love everything about their job, either they're inexperienced or they are being dishonest. There are some very tough aspects of the real estate profession. The toughest part of my job is the degree of variability and professionalism from the other side. I wouldn't say that's the toughest part. I feel like I'm used to it at this point. But there are agents like Patrick, and there are agents that are on the complete other spectrum from Patrick, and that have very little professionalism in how they communicate and how they work. And you have to deal with these counterparties. And so that is one of the toughest aspects. The other tough aspect can be the challenges in... So real estate catches people in major life stage transitions. People are getting married, they're getting divorced, there's a death in the family, they're moving to a new job. There's major things that occur, and I didn't know that getting into this business. And sometimes the heartache that goes with that can be emotionally challenging, and we then almost take on like a therapist role. And it's not, we're not your therapist, but we also have to listen and offer compassion and understanding for people going through difficult circumstances. And so I've had a family member whose sister passed away, and she had become a hoarder and had clear psychological issues going on, and they just wanted to be done. And so being tender and careful in how we handled that transaction was really important. I've had multiple clients that were going through divorces, and we have special rules now for divorcing clients because that container of trust between these two people is so broken that it is extremely easy to cause emotional roller coaster and flare up. And our mission is to help them be successful in getting out of this financial arrangement with each other. We're not here to heal the wounds from a relationship breakup, but we can certainly not create new ones with incompetence in how we handle a party that is warring with each other over these assets and over their broken relationship. I mean, it can be really painful. So these rules are based on many experiences with divorcing sellers. And having been divorced myself, I feel like I have a little more insight into what actually goes on in that process of a divorce. So it's not a specialty I want, by the way. So don't read that like bring on all the divorcing couples. We will take you on. But it is an additional layer of unexpected challenge. So those are some of the toughest deals. And then I guess a third deal that is really challenging is when we've gone under contract multiple times and we're representing the sellers. And we've had disingenuous buyers, buyers that flake for unexpected and frankly disingenuous reasons. And it can be really painful. It can waste a lot of their time. They feel like, you know, they're almost done with this process. They've done so much work in prepping and cleaning, and now they're dealing with somebody who's just kind of wasting their time on market, and it's frustrating. So that's the third toughest, is when, you know, we've had more than two strikes with buyers. That can be really painful. It's not common. It's only happened a few times for me, but it does happen. So I think that's off the top of my head what I think of as some of the most challenging parts of our job. What do you think, Hamish?
Yeah, for me, it's largely kind of balancing dynamics, and each person's unique, especially in real estate, since it's somewhat of a independent profession. You do find people from all sorts of different walks of life. So what's typically been a very professional or reasonable approach to one agent might totally set off the other one. And at the same time, it doesn't matter about the relationship between the agents when you've got this deal that you're trying to keep going. So it's like, you know, trying to keep heads cool so you can push through with this deal, but at the same time, it's working out this proper communication between all parties involved as well. So, you know, some agents are excellent at it, and then other ones you run into and you're like, what are we doing here? Also, Comic Sans is your email font? Okay. Sure. You know. So,
Comic Sans is usually a good indicator of professionalism level.
Yeah, it's a pretty solid one.
I'm just reminded of an experience while I was working for the investment firm in Denver. We were looking at acquiring a subdivision that was under construction, and the developer went bankrupt. And so we were looking at buying this out of bankruptcy at a real fraction of its value, and we had engaged a broker, this was on a beach community on the East Coast somewhere, to provide an opinion to value. And at the bottom of this broker's emails, every single one of his emails had a photo of him kicking back at the beach. And it was like every time there was a professional exchange of communication, you would see this photo of him at the beach. And it circulated in the entire investment group. Like, somebody took a screenshot and sent it to everyone and said, look at this clown that we've hired to give us an opinion of value. So yeah, professionalism is all over the map. Longevity is not necessarily an indication of professionalism. There are some people that are very good at sales and not professional, and they've been in the industry a long time. So that's why you have to interview people, even if they've been doing this 20 years or longer, like I have, even if they've been doing this 40 years, you should have a conversation, have a meeting, and get a sense for that level of professionalism before you sign that listing agreement or buy your agency agreement. And I should add one more piece. It's not just the interview. So what we do is we test drive. So if you're buying, we will go out with you three times, maybe four times. And at that point, after we've gone out and looked at listings three or four times, we're going to ask you to make a commitment. And we're also checking you out during this entire process too. The question is, can we actually meet your goals? Because if we can't, we don't really want you as a client, because we could waste a lot of time trying to achieve Mission Impossible. And I've learned that the hard way, that it doesn't matter how big of a deal is, if it's impossible to actually reach success, or it's extremely low probability, and these people don't want to hear, these buyers don't want to hear how this is actually going to be really challenging, or the seller doesn't want to hear about how their property has some issues that are going to make it hard to sell, it's better to just not engage the relationship. So we are test driving in the first several meetings with a client, buying or selling. Okay.
And that actually might be a talking point for us later on in a different podcast, is agents interviewing clients. There's a lot to be said kind of for the dynamic that goes back and forth, and picking an agent is just as important as an agent picking the right client.
Absolutely. Oh, 100%. That will be a topic for the future. You may want to make a note of that, Hamish, for our list of podcast topics.
Already got you.
Awesome. You are on it. All right, question six. Have you ever been subject to action by the real estate board or commission? If yes, what happened? If no, ask if they've had a grievance with a client that was challenging to solve and what they did to fix the situation. And in 2007, I wrote, use your state's real estate commission website to check the status of their license and whether they've had any recent disciplinary action. It's not a red flag by itself. However, a pattern of unethical, illegal behavior is troubling. Ask about any disciplinary action you find. How the agent resolved the situation tells you whether they think in terms of win-wins. It will also let you see how he speaks or thinks about his or her clients after the deal. So, remember, this was written a long time ago, and today we have resources way beyond the Real Estate Commission website and the complaint system. So you should always check Google and Zillow and Yelp and look for reviews. And it's very easy to write a negative review. So the fact that there is a negative review is not necessarily a bad thing. You want to see if they've responded to the negative review. And if they have not responded online, or even if they have responded online, you want to ask them about how it worked out. And I would say that, in fact, it might be a red flag if they have no negative feedback whatsoever on all the due diligence research you can find. If you can't find a single instance of somebody not happy, that by itself is at least a yellow flag. Like, what's going on with that? Because it's very difficult to make everyone 100% happy in life. So it would be a strange thing to find that somebody has perfect reviews on every single platform you can find. And I'll share with you where I know I have a negative review. If you go to our Google Maps, which is a weird place to leave a review, but this is where this person did it. We had a tenant. So House Einstein does manage rentals. It's not a primary part of our business. We don't advertise it, and I'm not advertising it now. We only do it for our existing clients, and only in certain circumstances, too. I will add that piece because it's not our mission, although we will take it on. And I had a tenant on one of my personal properties, one of my rentals, who broke the lease and caused a bunch of damage, and they ended up losing their security deposit, and they owed money on top of that because they were late on, they basically stopped paying rent on top of that. But luckily they left and we were able to fix the property and get it re-rented very quickly. But this person's father wrote a nasty review. And the nasty review was full of inaccurate representations. And I'm going to say that's at best. Okay, it was very much a libelous, right, exchange. It was very disreputable. I had never even worked with this guy. He wasn't on the lease, but he was clearly upset that his son had lost the security deposit. And, you know, I waited 2 days before responding. At least I think I did. You'll have to check the timeline. Maybe I responded faster, but I should have waited 2 days if I didn't. Because it's very triggering when somebody it's very triggering for me. When someone accuses me of something I have not done, I have a bug about it. I get very upset. I'm working on getting past that. But I responded with, you know, the facts of the matter and also provided a link to this person's profile as well, where they had lost their license to practice law in the state of Colorado for misappropriating funds. And I knew a lot more than that, but that was factual. And I provided that link to, you know, if you're checking out reputations, please note who's leaving this complaint. It's probably so buried at this point in Google Maps, you may not even be able to find it. But it's quite the backstory to it. And I'm not going to say much else because this person is you know, I don't want to encourage this person to take further legal activity because there's a tendency, it seems to me, of this person to do so. So better to just let it go. And that's what I'm doing now as well, because there's no point in digging up old dirt. But you do want to see how people respond to complaints. And you want to ask, you know, what's happened to you in the past? How did you fix a situation? What did you have a deal that didn't close? How did you resolve that situation? Did you have a buyer who you weren't able to succeed with, or a seller who had to take their house off the market? All of that is not uncommon, especially with so little inventory and sometimes sellers that have an exaggerated sense of their property's value, or who are not willing to do the work to make their property marketable, they may not be happy. And so how do you work through those situations is really what this question's about.
Yeah, and I think you can add to this question maybe a sub question, or, you know, maybe there's nothing in the Real Estate Commission or any real complaints, but you could ask, you know, is there a time in your career where you have just outright made a mistake? Because what you're looking for as well is kind of honesty, where the agent's willing to put their ego aside and their self-promotion and be kind of one-on-one, say, yeah, I've actually learned through my 20 years that I can't be negotiating like this, or I can't manage a client this way, or I've let something completely slip on the deal. But now, you know, it gives them an opportunity to admit mistake, admit fault, and then also show their growth. And I think you want to see an agent that's constantly trying to learn and improve as well.
Well said. Agree with you completely. And life is full of mistakes. And the question is, what did you learn? And how did you treat the people on your team, in the counterparty? How did you work through this mistake? How did this mistake happen? And how are you not going to make this mistake again? What was the impact of this mistake? You know, that's called getting out of integrity when mistakes happen like that. And ownership is a huge component of, I think, an ethical life, is mm-hmm. taking ownership of your mistakes and correcting them. And everyone makes them, including me, including you. And you know, you dust yourself off, you own your mistake, and you resolve to not have it happen again. And hopefully you have systems that prevent you from making that same mistake again.
Yep.
Next okay. Point. Let's see if we can. This may take us more than an hour, Hamish. I thought we'd cut through this really fast. I'm opening up a Spindrift. That's the sound of that beverage. It's not beer. Although who knows, maybe at some point we'll use beer on this podcast. But right now we're not doing that. All right, question 7. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. What neighborhoods should I look at? What areas should I avoid? Why? And my answer back then was, this is an easy question, but also another test. Real estate agents must abide by fair housing laws and cannot make discriminatory statements. They're also prohibited from steering clients into neighborhoods, good or bad. In my opinion, a correct approach to answering this question is to A, understand what the client's looking for by asking for specifics. What does a good neighborhood mean? And B, determine how to best help within the constraints of fair housing laws. The question is really an invitation for the agent to start asking you questions to get a sense of what you're looking for. If they rush to suggest neighborhoods without really understanding your situation, it's not a good sign. And go ahead.
Could you imagine if you ask an agent what a good neighborhood is and they just immediately funnel you into like the most dollar per square foot neighborhood or something?
Oh, yeah.
What a red flag, you know?
I mean, I've got stories about that too, of a buyer's agent asking the buyer one question the entire interview, and that was, are you private or public school people? That's all I need to know. And they were so just shocked by that question. And it was a clear no, you're not a good fit for us as an agent, if that's all the only question you have about our search. And it's sort of a tricky one because I get it, right? Like, you may feel more comfortable with people that represent your demographic. And you should have a right to choose where you want to live. But as a real estate agent, I'm not here to encourage you to make those decisions on a personal level. And I also have to abide by fair housing laws. So I have had buyers, it's only happened once, tell me they really wanted to live with people like them. That's all they said. But they were obviously, well, it was not obvious to you, but they were of a certain ethnic and racial and financial situation. And that's where we helped them buy, was a golf course community filled with people that were retirees and shared their demographics. And I didn't probe any further. I just, you know, I got the sense of what they were looking for. And it's kind of a tough one because it's not my value judgment, right? It's not uncommon people want to live with people that are similar to them. That's why there are diaspora communities all over the country. That's why there's a little China in San Francisco and in New York, and there's a little India. That's why my parents moved to a place that had a lot of people that were like them. In the middle of upstate New York, where you would never expect it, because through the grapevine they found out their friends were moving there. And so it's human nature. I don't begrudge people for wanting that, but real estate agents still need to abide by fair housing law, and they certainly should never steer people away from certain neighborhoods because they're not the same color or faith community. Like, you need to have questions that balance fair housing law. You have to abide by it with being a good human and also trying to serve your clients to the best of your ability. And it can be a gray area, and you have to abide by fair housing law, if nothing else. And I think you should also abide by higher standards where you don't encourage people, particularly if they're trying to exclude certain ethnic groups or racial makeup groups. That's, I don't know, we say no to clients. And this actually segues to, I think I'm going to pause for a second from our list of questions, Hamish, and
yeah.
And go to a question that's not on this list that I've been thinking a lot about. And it's one of the most important questions to ask an agent. And that is, tell me about a buyer or seller that you declined to work with and why. And if their answer is, no, we work with everybody, well, they're either inexperienced or lying, or they just don't have values that discriminate on this or that care about these things, I should say. And sometimes we choose to not work with clients because they're disrespectful. Actually, I know that. So there, I've got rules. I'm going to use a little profanity here. I'm going to go on an edge. This rule is called the no asshole rule. And in working with Sophie, I used to have a 3-strike-out policy for this. And she asked me why we're doing 3 strikes out when it's really clear this person's disrespectful. And she was right, from the mouths of babes. I'm like, we don't need to give somebody 3 strikes when they show you who they are. So one of my other sayings is and this is actually Oprah's saying, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. You don't need to give them 3 strikes. Sophie was right, Oprah's right, and respect for the people on my team is crucial, and I could tell stories again, real estate stories, but I won't. I'm trying to get faster through this podcast, but now it's very clear when somebody is showing disrespect, it's just not a good fit, no matter how big the commission check is. If it's very clear we can't achieve their goals, we tell them why and we decline the business. If it's clear they don't value the advice we're giving them, they don't want to believe it, and they're like, well, my neighbor was able to get $2.5 million for their house. Why is mine only worth 2? And they don't want to hear that their property is on a busy street or is not up against open space or
floodplain.
Flood, but the 100-year flood, but doesn't have a corresponding trade-off, because it's not a deal killer that it has a 100-year flood, but it is 100% a factor in pricing. And there should be a corresponding trade-off if you're buying a house with a 100-year flood. But you have to know that there's a huge percentage of the market that's not even going to go look at this thing. So if they're not hearing those things and acknowledging them, and they are pushing us at the same time on commissions, and they're incredibly demanding but not listening, like there's subtle signs that we're just not going to achieve success. We're going to spend a long time trying to help them and basically throwing ourselves up against the wall. And in the end, they're probably not going to sell their house for the price they think. Like, if they say, no, we want you to list it at this extreme value, when we do so, all we're doing is tying it up for a year, constantly a negative experience working with them. They're not going to be happy with us. They're going to sell it for far less ultimately than it's worth. And in the context of how long that working relationship could be, you know, a year into it, our listing agreement could expire. They fire us and they hire somebody else who immediately prices it low and sells it. And it's like one of these things where, well, there's no reason to do this behavior anymore. So if we can't achieve success, we need to say no thank you, politely and respectfully decline the business. And it happens to me about twice a year. That it's clear we're not going to be able to achieve success. We also don't, serve the general public. People find us. They find our content. They read our content. They get to know how we do business. So they're self-filtering. If they just look for the shiny wrapper, there's tons of brokerages out there that are shiny wrappers that will take anybody as an agent and look very pretty and offer reputation to the credibility, reputational credibility to new agents. That's their business model. They should go there. That, you know, that's who I think they should move with, and not with us, because we can't get there. So that's an important question to ask. Yeah. To ask people you're trying to interview to be your agent. All right, let me keep going. Unless you had anything to add there, Hamish.
I think that's it. You know, you're a person of standards. If you're interviewing somebody to be your agent, you want them to have a level of standard and kind of commitment too. It won't be as fulfilling as if you just choose somebody who chooses everybody, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, question 8. How are real estate conditions, and what will you do to market my home? And in 07, I wrote, look for answers that reflect current conditions in the market and for suggestions that help your home stand out from the competition. When they say the market's good or bad, ask for more details. Is that for all price ranges? And how they know? Generalisms about the market are meaningless because conditions vary strongly by price range and location. Watch for marketing approaches that have little impact, including most newspaper and periodical advertising. Strong web marketing strategies and a wide professional network are a plus. Note, if you're a buyer and not selling a property, you can still use this question by phrasing it hypothetically. Still true, although I will add that today we don't just do online marketing. We do what most agents do, most professional agents do, with high-quality professional photography, but we also do a layer of videography that very few agents do, except at the very high end. And then we push that content across all of our socials. And it's still, so you get the base level that you should get from a realtor or real estate agent. And then we go even beyond that and we track it. So in some cases, we try to help people understand the value of a neighborhood because the neighborhood is not that well known. Like Newlands, everyone knows about. But Noble Park, probably not. Arapahoe Ridge? Probably not, unless you live here in the community. So if you're relocating here, these types of pieces of content are really useful to help people understand not just the value of the house we're selling, but also the value of the neighborhood. So we're selling the neighborhood too, to try to encourage people to consider it. And I will add one more piece, last piece to this, is that this was written in 07. The market was falling apart. Today, the market has extremely low inventory. And it's extremely competitive, except at the very, very high end of the market right now. And you won't find me talking about the market in general unless I've done the data analysis. Unless I put that together, I feel like there's just too much generalization. And most agents are prone to talking about their own business and do not have the skill set to do the detailed market analysis on a neighborhood. And so you'll get a lot of happy talk, but you won't get a lot of data. And if you're a client, I will go into the data war room with you and I'll show you the data and I'll even do the analysis in real time so you can see what I'm seeing. And then we can have an intelligent conversation about how the market is. And with respect to how will you market my home, I think we've touched on that. Professional videography, staging, correction of likely inspection issues, extensive due diligence disclosures, all to increase trust, very ethical and transparent ways of negotiation and marketing so that people feel confident we're not hiding anything with our listings. And then we package it all with some very, I think, class leading for our market, videography and photography, and we drive as much traffic to go see that staged house as possible. We also want to make sure it's priced right. And pricing is the next question, so I'm going to just jump to that. 9, what's your process for helping me figure out how much my home is worth? And this is one of, you know, this is one of the first questions that sellers want to ask is, what do you think my house is worth? And correct pricing is critical. So this is what I wrote in 07. Pricing is critical in normal and down markets. If you test the market with a high price and it turns out to be too high, your home will probably be on the market for a long time. If you underprice, you leave money on the table. The no-brainer answer is to look at the comparables. However, using the MLS website to spit out an automated comparative market analysis, or CMA, without further work is a disservice to the client. That approach often leaves large margins of error as there are a lot of differences between homes. Sorry, I'm paraphrasing. There are big differences between homes that may at first appear to be comparable. To provide you with accurate guidelines for value, agents should personally visit homes and take the time to do an in-depth analysis. At Realty Unique, now House Einstein, we put in a great deal of effort to help clients price their home for maximum value. We call it an opinion to value, an investment banking term that more accurately reflects the level of due diligence required. Note, if you're a buyer and not selling a property, you could still use this question by phrasing it hypothetically. Whew, that's a lot of words. still accurate. I will add that what I wrote in 2007 is still accurate. It's just gotten even more rigorous. So now we do multiple stages of pricing. Zillow is good for plus or minus 10%, but usually before we sign a listing agreement, we'll do a price analysis and provide that to our client, but it's a general opinion. And then right before we go active, so now we've done all the prep, the photography, the videography, the staging, the deep cleaning, the decluttering, all the things that are part of prepping a home for sale. Maybe the seller's done landscaping. Now it's time to price it to the competition right before we go active. Because if you don't price to the competition, all you do is sell other people's houses because your home is mispriced. It's overpriced. You sold somebody else's house. It's underpriced. You left money on the table, unless that was your intention, a bidding war. That occurs right before we go active. And then throughout the lifespan of the listing, we are checking the competition at least once a week until it's under contract to make sure that we are priced appropriately, that there are no new competitors that are blowing it out of the water. And if there are new competitors, our client has a decision to make. Wait for that house to sell if it's better priced and a better house, or adjust your pricing and your choice. And it may just make sense to wait because sometimes agents underprice as a strategy. And just because somebody else is selling their house at a discount or way below market doesn't mean you should. But without that analysis that goes on throughout the lifespan of the listing, you won't even have any information to act on. You'll just be wondering in the dark what the heck is going on with your listing. So once a week, we review pricing. We also check on feedback. And that means a direct phone call to every agent that's shown the property. We don't just do automated feedback. Okay, Hamish, you haven't said anything in a while. It's been all me.
Question number two on our blog post is negotiation strategy, and I think it wraps in pretty well to pricing strategy. Those two are fairly hand in hand. It's how you want to play the market. You know, if you're in up market, maybe you want to test the higher ceiling of what the comps are, or in a down market, maybe you're trying to just sit in the middle. But it really starts right around pricing, and that's where the approach to have as much data as we can across, you know, maybe it's a shorter timeline, but we're looking for all the competition, all the similarities to really have like a proper landscape. It's really important for kind of getting in there at the right price.
You touched on a very important part of the equation. Part of this is the seller strategy. Are you intentionally pricing high with the intention of discounting, which is much more common at the high end? Or are you trying to price it low and get a bidding war? And also, are we in the upswing or the down cycle of the season? Because real estate has a season. There's a seasonality factor to consider. And then there's unique factors that may occur, like as soon as COVID unlocked, the market was insane. And it was unlike any market I've ever participated in. I've never seen people spend that much over list. And some of those people are regretting it now. Because they acted without discipline in those negotiations. They went way over list price, and now they're trying to sell it, and they're finding that the competition is going to keep them from getting even close to what they bought it for. So yeah, absolutely. It's a conversation with the seller. Timing comes into play, and a lot of data analysis comes into play. It's not just happy talk. And one more piece, it also involves phone calls. So I really like to call the competitor agents to see what's going on. And in a small market like Boulder, most of the time I know who the agent is. And usually we have a good reputation working relationship. We have that with most agents in Boulder. And so when I call them, it's a 5-minute phone call. Hey, Bob, how's it going? Just wanted to check in. We're getting ready to list a competitor to your house on Main. And I've noticed, you know, you've been under contract for 2 weeks. Could you kind of give me a sense of how many offers you got and how tough the negotiation was and were there concessions and where you might close? Because all the buyers that are looking at my house, Bob knows they're going to come. They've looked at his. So that house is in their mind. And that deal is in their mind. And if we find out there were 15 offers and we're 100,000 over list, well, we know something that is very useful for pricing. And our seller will make the ultimate call, but we would probably recommend maybe bridging the gap, right? Because if it's 100,000 over list and there were 15 offers, maybe somebody was dumb. And is that same dumb person out there? I shouldn't say dumb. Somebody let emotions drive their decision making, and they had plenty of resources financially, and they decided it was worth it to them to spend $100,000 more than list price. And that one person is no longer in the pool of 14 remaining buyers. So maybe you don't want to go $100,000 over and match the sale price of the competitor. Maybe you want to go to 50. But it's up to you as the seller, and that's the kind of intel that we provide our clients when we are evaluating pricing before list and during the listing process itself while it's on the market. Okay, let's go to question 10. We're almost done. There are three questions left. If you're still listening, I really appreciate it letting us go through this process with you. So 10, how many clients are you currently working with and what's your availability? Will you be helping me yourself? Or will you delegate my transaction to an associate or assistant? And in 07, I wrote, is the agent taking on more than they can realistically handle or handle well? This is my answer. Do they have any vacations planned for the next 6 to 8 weeks? Do they have a team or assistants that can help out? At Realty Unique, we work one-on-one with our clients. This gives us the ability to better serve clients during peak weekend periods. In some cases, we may rely on assistants or other business partners to help. However, most of the time, you're dealing directly with us. It's critically important that the agent you pick is available and responsive. So all of that's still true, except that today with Hamish, you're licensed, you do showing coverage. The other agents on the team, we also cover each other. And having worked with these agents for years, I believe that we share our values. Our integrity is something that we care about deeply. And I tell my buyers that I will never go out of town without a plan to make sure you have showing coverage with somebody that's competent. And in most cases, I will also be available to write offers and negotiate on your behalf. In rare instances, once a year, I go out of town for about 2.5 weeks where I will not be in touch very easily. And during that time period, if you're writing an offer, you will likely be writing an offer with Sophie or Ian leading the deal. But these are top agents in their field. Sophie is easily in the top based on her time on in the industry, her experience working both with me as an associate and then on her own as a broker associate with House Einstein. She kills it. Like, you're in incredible hands with anybody on the team. And you won't miss out on a house because Osmond's out of town for a couple of weeks in the fall. So I think it's important to get a sense of that because there are some agents in the local market and in other markets that are mostly a brand, right? It's like a well-known attorney. I'm not going to say his name especially, but there's a well-known attorney whose billboards are all over town. Who represents all over Colorado, frankly, who represents a lot of people that get injured. And this attorney, you're unlikely to actually deal with this attorney directly. You're going to deal with an associate. It's mostly a branding effort. And the same thing is true in real estate, where there are brokerages and there are agents who do so much volume that you are very unlikely to be directly communicating with them once the process is underway. They have a listing manager, a closing manager, somebody that turns on and off lights, somebody that changes signs in and out. And it doesn't mean that they're not a bad agent. They might have a great team. But I've been at closings with that particular agent where they've introduced themselves to my client thinking they were their client. They just had never even met the seller. And because of how we walked through the door and were seated, they thought that the people, I think I sat on the wrong side of the table. That might have been what happened, and it threw this agent.
I mean, but still.
Yeah. Well, she said, my name is, and this is not her real name, my name is Jane Smith. I'm your agent. It's great to meet you. And I'm like, they're my clients. Your clients haven't walked in the door yet. So, you know, just that lack of personal connection might be something to think about. It doesn't mean that they're bad agents. They get deals done, but it's certainly, if you're one of 100 deals they're working on at any given time, how much do you think they care about you as a client and your goals, your needs?
And that kind of circles back to where you're saying, you know, real estate is during people's large life events. And I for me, it's just so strange that you have these agents that entirely delegate and essentially automate everything. They have the brand and that's it. It's so strange that they get a lot of clients, because I ideally want somebody who works with me pretty one-on-one, who's, you know, kind of has my entire goals and mindset in the back of their head. It's just so crazy. It's like big business real estate with a single person's brand. It's an interesting kind of model.
I mean, I could have put my name on this company and said it's Osman Real Estate Company, and I find like that doesn't make any sense. I want to grow an entity that has people in it that share the same values, have high levels of integrity, high standards of service, are invested in our community, are trying to do the best they can to serve people from the base of their values, not because it makes them the most money. And putting my name on the brokerage would have probably made me more money, but I also feel like it's the wrong way to brand yourself if you're trying to build a long-term sustainable business. So at least one that serves your values, right? Like, there are businesses out there that may not be quite so ethical and make more money. But again, making money is not the primary mission of this company. All right, let's hit question 11.
Okay.
Do you have any real estate designations? What do they mean? Or how does that help you provide better service? How many hours of education were required to earn that designation? And my answer was, look for a pattern of continuing education and commitment to the profession. Real estate designations are a form of continuing education and reflect an agent's continuing efforts to serve clients at the highest possible level. Still true. But I'll add that there are a number of phony designations in the industry. These are designations you pay for, you take a 4-hour course, or sometimes even less, a 2-hour course, and suddenly you have a designation that says you're an expert in sustainability, or you're an expert in green building. And the truth of the matter is, it's like a couple of hours, and then you pay an annual fee to be able to call yourself that. And the fee could be like $30 a year. It's not a legit credential. With that said, there are legit credentials. The GRI, the CRS, and both of those require you to have been in the industry for a certain period of time and have done a number of transactions, and also completed an extensive continuing education regimen way beyond what the Real Estate Commission requires you to take. And those are good signs, but they're not the only sign.
Yeah, my question for you is, I'm, say, you know, fresh off the boat, potential client interviewing agents. How do I differentiate between kind of the less legitimate designations and GRI, CRS? What would be a Google or something for me to know what's a real cert?
It's a tough one. Yeah. That's why you should ask them about it and see how they back it up and how well they know it. So for example, if the person says, I'm a certified negotiation expert, or CNE, that designation actually has value because it's built off of the Harvard negotiation course. And I love negotiation, right? I pay a lot of attention to negotiation. I've taken a lot of coursework in negotiation. And that's actually a pretty useful course for people that want to understand the basics of real estate negotiation. And the people that just go into it thinking that they can negotiate because they once bought or sold a house are unlikely to be as driven to help you achieve your goals as somebody who is actually invested in a designation that has real value. So this is the question. Ask the person to explain it that you're interviewing. Why are you advertising yourself as this designation? What did you learn? How do you use that to apply in your business to benefit your clients? And see how they answer it. But if they just have a string of letters after their name, it doesn't mean anything. And I'll also add that sometimes GRI or CRS actually doesn't mean anything either. It just means they've been in the industry a long time and they like taking courses. They like educating themselves, but they don't actually use those things to benefit their clients. That's why you need to ask, how does that benefit me as your buyer or seller, as your client? And listen to what they have to say. All right, ready for 12? Last question. How good are you using How good are you using the internet to better serve your clients? How often will you update me on showings for sellers or newly available property for buyers? And my answer in 2007 was more than 80% of real estate transactions begin online. You obviously want an agent that's web savvy. Old pros may have a great deal to offer in the way of experience, but if they struggle to send an email or don't know how to set up an online search properly, you could lose out. Sometimes an ideal pairing is an older, experienced agent and a younger, technologically sophisticated associate or assistant. At Realty Unique, we spend a great deal of time marketing online and learning about the latest tools that might help our clients get an edge. Sometimes we're even developing those tools ourselves. For example, this blog and our Boulder development map. Well, first I kind of want to walk back what I wrote in 2007 because it sounds a little ageist. And we are maybe I'm just getting older and I'm more sensitive to ageism. But
yeah, good point.
There are lots of people that are of advanced age, or I would say have a lot more experience, that are also technically savvy. One of our closest friends is in his late 70s and is more tech savvy than I am in almost all things. So tech savvy is not necessarily correlated with how many years you've been alive on the planet. And I do think that sometimes it makes sense to pair younger agents and more experienced agents. We have a deal right now where there's a software signature system that is used, and the transaction coordinator is basically making sure all the signatures are signed, the deal file is complete. But the agent who is representing the buyer is much more verbal, phone call, emails, but can't do the electronic signatures very well, is struggling a little bit with that software package. And that's totally fine. It doesn't mean she's a bad agent. But you do want to get a sense of what tools they're using and how quickly they can respond. So, for example, we've been using a calendar booking system for our buyers for a long, long time. And when you're under buyer agency with me, I give you a link. Actually, this link is available on the blog too, but I'll ignore it if it's not a client. And this shows you my availability. And I tell my clients that, look, if there's a hot listing you want to go see, block my calendar as soon as that matches you. Don't wait for me to call you back or email you back. When in this market, even now in 2023, where the market has cooled somewhat, there is a competitive advantage to seeing a listing fast. You have more time to make an intelligent decision. You're under less pressure. You have the option to be the first offer on the table if you decide to offer at all. There's so many advantages to getting to see the listing fast, earlier than the competition. So I want to help my clients do that. And that's why, Hamish, you're sometimes on call if I'm away for the weekend. It's like putting on a little red flashing light. That's my imagine, that's what I imagine. You know, you're putting on a little red flashing light on top of your car and you're flying to the listing like a fireman to put out the fire because it is such an advantage to our clients. So those, tech tools and responsiveness go hand in hand. But it's not the only factor, obviously. And today, I would say 99.9% of real estate transactions begin online. It's not 80%.
I was going to say that post itself is just showing its age, being in 2007, where web schools aren't kind of all over the show, you know?
Yeah. And languaging is changing, right? I would be very hesitant to talk about the age of somebody today. Because it's not necessarily correlated. And again, I think that's just because I'm 15 years older or whatever from when I wrote this piece originally. So let's hit on anything left. So I'm looking at our outline here, Hamish. We reviewed the old blog post. We talked about some new questions to ask, including difficult deals and approaches to pricing. We didn't really hammer home the question not to ask, which is, what's my house worth? I think that doesn't, if you're choosing an agent based on how much they think your house is worth, you're doing yourself a disfavor. You really want to get into their process for pricing a house. Delivering that information, if a seller isn't really comprehending that, like they don't really understand the importance is not so much about what I think it's worth today, it's the overall process of accurately and intelligently pricing the home for maximum value. it might not be a good fit for a client because they're asking the wrong question. If they insist on, again, saying, no, what's my house worth? Okay, I think we've covered this topic pretty well to death. Do you think anything I'm missing, Hamish, or we're missing?
Just on the what's the house worth thing, you know, it's not, or at least in my mindset, it shouldn't be the agent's opinion of the worth of the house. At least the way we do things is we're looking at the market. It's what the market's, the price of the house is in relation to the market. Our opinion, and you know, we love this house, we think it should be worth $5 million. But it's not. We're going to present what the market data suggests. You know, it's not objective. And so, yeah.
Mr. Market wins in the end. It's not what the seller thinks it's worth. It's what a buyer's willing to pay. But we can influence what a buyer's willing to pay dramatically by correcting obvious visual defects, inspection items, by... somebody's buzzing. Maybe turning that off. By staging it properly. Good stagers are not just making the house look pretty. They are often overcoming deficits in the property itself. And I'll give you an example. We listed a house, this is like 7 years ago. Actually, we're having dinner with the seller tonight, Hamish. And this house had a major problem. The living area, dining room flow was kind of choppy, and the eating area was really small. Like, where do you eat? Where is the dining room? And our stager noticed it immediately and brought in furniture to suggest a seating area for eating and laid it out in a way that made sense. And the vast majority of people would never have realized that a normal dining table does not fit in this space. And we had a bidding war. It sold for more than list. And 2 weeks after it closed, the buyer's agent called me and said, can you give me the list of buyers that submitted? Because my buyer doesn't want the house anymore. It's too small for them. They never even finished moving in. They stayed in their old house. As a courtesy, I gave them the list. And they sold it to another buyer's agent. And I'm pretty sure something happened on the commission side of that deal. But it wasn't our problem. All I know is, you know, we scratched the back of the buyer's agent who did buy the house, and they did sell it to another buyer's agent, to another buyer who was part of our original bidding war process. Okay. I think with that, let's wrap it up. This has been a great podcast number 4. Hopefully the recording is useful. And I'm Osmond with House Einstein.
Hamish with House Einstein.
Yep, Hamish with House Einstein. You can find us at houseeinstein.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast, and we will catch you next time.
All righty. Take care, everybody.